Hello, my name is Joshua Clark, and I'm here with Gerald McKibben.
Hello, my name is Gerald McKibben. Not sure why I don't feel like I've done anything worthy of recording, but Josh has an interest in it, and I told him I'd be happy to answer his questions or whatever questions he might have. I haven't done anything spectacular. But anyway, I'm happy to answer whatever questions Josh might, for whatever reason, might like to hear about.
When did you start writing?
I've actually got some terrible little poem quality-wise. They were terrible. I wrote when I was in high school. And they're just, you know, love the outdoors. So in the spring, I'd be thinking about the birds singing. So I wrote typical little kid stuff. You know, the birds are singing and all that kind of thing. So I guess when I was a young teenager, I was kind of interested in trying to put something down on paper. And I was a prolific reader, so, and I was interested in nature. So as soon as I could, like in high school, discovered John James Audubon's big book of birds, you know. I checked that out of the library a lot and took it home with me. But I would daydream in class and I'd write silly little, in hindsight, I could imagine I was outside and it's spring of the year and birds are singing and I don't know what all. So I put down some things, just terrible poetry, but very few. So I wrote very few poems when I was in high school, and they would be adolescent stuff.
Yes, sir.
But I guess in all of my reading, I guess later I got interested in more, somewhat interested in writing. But the way I was, my writing reflected what I was interested in. So I got interested in airplanes. I mean, from the time I was a young teenager, ended up eventually getting a pilot license, and I built three airplanes. And I flew as a private pilot for over 50 years. So I would tend to write about what I was interested in. So I got interested in writing for some of the flying magazines. We had two or three of those. That's why most of what I published were stories about airplanes and flying, some of it fairly technical stuff, but I just wrote about what I was interested in, and airplanes were just an avocation of mine for many years. I just dreamed of learning to fly, and so finally did, and wrote no more. I wasn't a prolific writer and wrote no more than couple dozen articles maybe about flying.
Yes, sir.
One of the last ones I wrote, I went to Sun and Fun Flying and down below Jacksonville, Florida. It's one of the big fly-ins. It'd be probably 10 or 20,000 airplanes there. The biggest one's in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I flew into there one time. And this particular article shows how an editor can really help. I had sold a few articles to Sport Aviation. So I remember the editor name was Mary Jones. So I thought about going to fly to the fly-in down there. And I sent an email to the editor And I told her the idea I had. I was going to Sun and Fun Fly In, and I wanted to write an article about the title that we ended up with was Propellers for High Performance Home Built Airplanes. So she said, how about coming to the EA tent, Experimental Aircraft Association tent? She said, you can't miss it. It's a huge tent. Ask for me, Mary Jones. So I did that and found Mary. She made it so easy. She said, here, when an editor tells you what they'd like to see, well, then you got it made, you know. Mm-hmm. So she said, here's what I'd like to see. I'd like for you to roam out over the grounds. And she said, you know, some of the people who build an airplane, they hang around their airplane to answer questions because people will drop by. And they won't all be out there, but she said, if you walk over the grounds, and I'd been to that before, she said, you'll find a guy standing around leaning against the airplane and go up and introduce yourself. Ask, did he build the airplane? Then if he did, she said, I'd like for you to interview them. Ask them what kind of propeller you put on it. The mate, Sensenich is one, and Hartzell is another. I was familiar with most of those. She said, I would like for you to interview that person and maybe take a picture of him standing by his airplane and ask him why he chose the propeller he did for his airplane. Well, I was tickled to death when she told me that because, I mean, that made it easy. I knew exactly what she wanted to do.
Yes, sir.
And I did what was fun anyway. So I roamed around. I took pictures of the builders, and I had quite a few pictures. And the airplanes themselves were pretty because this was a high-end experimental that I was interested in. That's what I built, a kit plane. I mean, it cruised about 160 miles an hour. And I was debating about whether to go to Sun and Fun because I figured I would spend $500 gasoline for the airplane. You had to pay a camping fee. Took my tent with me. And food. So I figured I'd spend $500. So when she wrote me back and she was very positive about it, I said, I think, you know, she'll buy the article that I write if she likes it. So really that paid for my trip down there. That was about what she paid, $500. So
yes, sir.
Paid my... paid the expenses of the trip down there. I enjoyed that because I just met a lot of people. And I asked them, why'd you choose this Sensenich prop? Or I told her I told the people I interviewed. That was the easiest story I wrote because I told the person who had built his plane that I was writing an article for Sport Aviation, and that's the main magazine for the Experimental Aircraft Association. They sponsor these big fly-ins. So that was an easy one because I started out every day. I knew exactly what I was going to do. And the people were interested, and I'd take a picture of them. One guy had his either little girl or grandchild, I believe his little girl. And so I got her picture in there, too. And that made it real easy. Plus, every day I knew what I was going to do. That's the easiest one I wrote. You know, because when you interview people, they're really telling you their story. So I made notes. And so I got back home and put it all together and sent to her. And she published most of the pictures that I sent her. I've got the magazine somewhere in there, I think, in the den I could show you. That's writing, but it's reporting, you know.
Yes, sir. What about, you also wrote about a lot about hunting and fishing, didn't you?
Articles not and such. Much. I've got a gar fish that long. We'll need to go to the shop because that gar was about this long. It's a long-nosed gar, and it weighed 15 pounds. I wrote that up. When we lived in North Carolina, I did some writing for outdoor magazines, and that was one I wrote up about how I rigged up my gear to go catch that gar that I had seen. Gar come to the surface to get air occasionally, and I'd go down to what we call the 20-mile canal. And so that was when we lived in North Carolina, 77 through 82.
Yes,
but it didn't do much fishing. I wrote several articles for the Outdoor Magazine that they didn't accept. So I really wasn't in tune. Mm-hmm. And one I wrote about, this buddy and me just fishing and what a good time we had. And then one time I read their, they had a piece on the editorial page, what we're interested in. They told the kind of stories they're interested in. And said, what we're not interested in is when Bubba and me went fishing together and Bubba fell in and I laughed at him. Well, that's about what I wrote. They said, that's not what we're, we don't want those kind. So I didn't fit in well with writing about the outdoors, which was my number one, one of my big interests. In North Carolina, they had a small magazine that they about the outdoors, so I did send one to them. I don't think they paid anything. And I wrote one for the Mississippi Outdoors about colloquial names of birds, and that was pretty popular. They published that. I've got a copy of it somewhere because I grew up in Northeast Mississippi and all the country people had colloquial names for the birds. And since I was very interested in birds, I learned what their accepted names were. And so that was a real popular one. People wrote me from several states in the country. They used to live in Mississippi and they moved away, so they still took that outdoor magazine. Mm-hmm. So I heard that was, I wrote another article about the response from the readers. Mm-hmm. You know, one doctor called me from Tupelo and he described a bird song and what we called it. And I knew immediately that was a wood thrush. So those were interesting. I wrote a second article about the people who wrote me. Like a guy from New Jersey said he grew up in Mississippi and he never knew the real name for a snowbird. The Junco was the name of it. So I published that, and that was more interesting to me than my original article because it was people from all over the country. And I reminded them of a name they hadn't heard since they were a kid, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
So I like birds, and those are the easiest things. I wrote, the title was Colloquial Names for Mississippi Birds. I'm really interested also in the culture in which I grew up. A lot, most of the people of Northeast Mississippi were of Anglo-Saxon origin. That included the Scottish people. And my mother was a Hopkins, and the Hopkins were some of the people, they even had their family crest, you know. I looked it up the other day. So the Hopkins were from, primarily, I believe, from Scotland. So a lot of the people brought with them names that were handed down from the original home and somewhere in Europe, one of the British Isles, typically Scotland. So there's a bird we have and that figured prominently in my article, is called a shack poke. And we were in a car one day, my stepdad and my mother and Don and me, driving across the 20-mile bottom. The 20-mile creek was a major deal there, part of the landscape in the big, wide bottom land that was farmed, and we'd cross the 20-mile creek bottom, go up into another neighborhood where my grandfather and uncles and aunts lived. So one day we were driving along, and this bird, pretty big bird, about this long, flew up from the road ditch, and I asked my stepdaddy, I said, "What was that bird?" He said it was a shack poke. So I remembered that. And as it turns out, that's what the colonists called it. First place, the shack poke, for some reason when he flies, his bowels work. He just uses the bathroom on the way up. Then I got looking at old English, S-H-I-T-E, used to be spelled, we spell it S-H-I-T now, but they had an E on it, so that was shite. And a poke, where I grew up, a poke is a bag, a paper bag. Every time the shite poke takes off, he makes a squawking sound and runs out of him there. So the colonists, you see what they called him. He was a poke, a bag full of it. And it's called a green heron. So in my article, a lot of people, I got a lot of correspondence after I wrote that, because these people, it's in the Mississippi Game and Fish magazine. And a lot of people grew up like I did, and they knew the colloquial names. For example, the yellowhammer is what we call a flicker, because the underside of his wings are yellow. But it's a misnomer. The yellowhammer is in England. If colonists saw the yellow on him, they called him a yellowhammer. It's the northern flicker. I see him in my front yard a lot. So with me, I was interested in where my folks came from. The Hopkins came from Edinburgh, Scotland. I found out that my mother was a Hopkins. And of course, my dad is a McKibben, and there are a lot of McKibbens in Ireland, and some in England, too. But I was interested in that, too, and as it related to the birds. Birds were my big hobby. So this article, I called the editor and I asked him, could I get permission to send that to somebody else that wanted to publish it, republish it? He said, "You have our," of course it's a state, part of the Game Fish Commission, and so it's a not-for-profit thing. He said, "You have my permission to send it to anybody that wants to publish it." So I did send out several of those from the people who wrote me. That's 10 years ago, I guess, 15 years ago.
So what about your sculpting? What made you get interested in that?
In what?
Sculpting, like the building, like the stegosaurus outside.
Yeah. I did wood carving when I was a kid. I just learned, we were in the Boy Scouts, and that was one of the hobbies they promoted. So later, I don't call myself a sculptor because I'm not enough of an artist. So what I do is build models. The Kentrosaurus is across the road over there, and the giant ants in the front yard.
Yes, sir.
So an artist does things I don't do. I mean, if I want to make an ant, what I do is take an ant picture, measure the insect has three body sections. I measure those body sections, and then I scale them up and carve that ant out. There's the body's made out of styrofoam. The legs are made out of rebar, so I learned to weld. So it has steel legs. The body parts are carved out of styrofoam, and I covered them with fiberglass. Get epoxy resin and fiberglass, and you paint it on, and you got a, it's not bulletproof, but you got a tough surface. I made a barrier over here across the road out of concrete and sent a picture to the manager of the Tishomingo State Park. Told him I'd be willing to donate it and set it up there if he was interested. And he said, yes, by all means. So that's the one Don has patched up, excuse me, not long ago.
Yes, sir.
This is 10 years ago, I guess. So what I did, I just made a model of a bear. Then the museum in Jackson, we have a state museum on Lakeland Avenue in Jackson. The lady that ran the museum at the time, she saw the one up there. She called me if I could make a bear for them, and I made a bear for them and two giant ants. And people call it sculpting, you know, and all, but I object to that because, and I just tell them, I said, well, I'm not a sculptor. I build models. I can take something interesting to me like an ant. Now, I'm an entomologist too, so I'll measure the length of the abdomen, the length of the head and the thorax. Yeah, insect has three body parts. Then I'd measure the length of each section of the leg, and I'd get rebar and weld them, paint, and I'd have a piece of steel in the thorax, and before I put the foam on it, I would weld the steel part of the thorax to the legs. Then I had a steel structure. Rebar will bounce if you mash up and down because the legs are so long, they're limber. Then I carve the styrofoam body parts to scale. I mean, they're carved to scale like that. That's a mosquito out there in the front yard, about 6 or 8 feet long. It's Aedes aegypti. I mean, it was a special kind of mosquito, so it's made to scale. So I'll see sculptures by people who are real artists, and I'm not an artist. So what I do is build models.
Why don't you consider yourself an artist?
To give you an idea, the other day I saw a picture, an artist, a sculptor around Jackson, donated a bear to the museum also. My bear, I got gobs of pictures to show you, but it's the one, Tishomingo, I've made two or three. My bear is static. Artists make things that are dynamic. My bear, I just measured everything. It's just a bear standing. So I build models. It's a model of a bear. And I've been accused of being a sculptor, but I'm not really a sculptor. Anyway, recently saw in the paper, there's a sculptor down at Jackson, made a bear and donated it to the museum in Jackson. Well, it's a young bear, and he started with a tree trunk about this big around, and it's so high. And well, I don't see how they do it, but he carved the wood and carved the bear clinging to the wood, and it's climbing, it's dynamic. I mean, that's art. so I don't call mine art. If you go to Knoxville Refuge, I've got two woodpeckers and about a 6-foot damselfly that's on the headquarters building. Fortunately, they put it on the under the overhang of the building, the office building. That way it's not exposed to the weather. Paint fades, and then if it rains on it, it'll start peeling. So I was tickled to death when they displayed it there. It's been there several years. But it's just perfect. When you park and walk up to the headquarters building, you look up there, there's about a 6 or 8 foot damselfly perched there. It's got long wings and a long abdomen. But it's out of the sunlight and the rain, so the paint still looks good on it, you know. So really, I build models. And you have to sculpt them, too, so I guess maybe that could call me a
sculptor.
Some sort of sculptor, too. But I've looked at things. I know people who work with wood and build things. Their things are dynamic.
Yes, sir.
And they've got something I don't have. I've got a friend, Leland James. He lives at Longview, and he's been a wood carver. But he's an artist. He has made some, he even sculpts. He'll take a piece of wood, and he will carve a face in that wood. I'm more interested in doing animals than people. But I don't have what it takes to sculpt a human form. Artists do that. And,
that was my conversation with Gerald McKibben. Thank you for listening.